This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Nespresso, bringing you the perfect blend of global market analysis and insights.
BFM 89.9, good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Wong Xiaoning, and joining me in the studio this morning is Philip C. It is 7:05, Tuesday, the 2nd of November. And to join us for some thoughts on where global markets are heading, we speak to Joel Quinlan, Chief Market Strategist at the US Trust Bank of America Private Wealth Management. Good morning, Joe. Now, what we do know is 80% of S&P 500 companies have reported earnings that beat street expectations, leading markets even higher. But I want to know your thoughts, Joe. Do you think this is peak earnings cycle for markets, though?
If it's not peak for earnings, it's pretty darn close. We're having a gangbuster earnings season again. Companies are being allowed to pass on these prices. So you're worried about wages and bottleneck, but they're passing it on. The margins are pretty good. The markets continue to grind higher. But I can't see this continuing. So I think Q3, Q4, this is the peak. But we'll get on the other side in early first half of next year. Profits are still going to look good on a quarter-to-quarter basis.
And, you know, I want to get a perspective on bond yields because they're showing quite a bit of volatility compared to stocks. Is it a function of the multiple conflicting signals we get as, you know, major policymakers make decisions next week?
It is in the sense that the volatility reflects the fact that the markets increasingly think the Fed is behind the curve, that they're going to have to move faster. We've brought forward a lot of the interest rate hikes for next year. We're tapering in this month. The Fed is speaking this week. So a lot of that volatility is really around uncertainty. So the Fed's got a very delicate positioning to do here with the markets in terms of where are they going, what they expect. To get more aligned with the market that, you know, inflation is more, I think, kind of more persistent than transitory.
Meanwhile, I noticed something interesting on Bloomberg this morning, and that is the small cap index Russell 2000 is up 2.65% and also up more than 20% on the year to date. Is it too late to relook at small caps?
No, I don't think it's too late because I think next year, kind of granularly speaking, we get back to normalizing interest rates, more organic growth. We got to look at the overseas, what's happening. Small caps is a good place to put some money to work. So we've had these mini bull runs, we get these pullbacks, and then the bull run again. So small caps, for the long-term investor, this is a good place to be. So, you know, you never want to buy anything after it's up 20%, but you don't want to wait for 10% down. But small caps should be all part and parcel of anyone's portfolio.
And I want to bring this conversation closer to home and Southeast Asia and ASEAN. You know, we are in this region where things look up, where things are really reopening again. You know, in your view, would you add ASEAN into your portfolio?
Well, I mean, hopefully, I mean, Malaysia in particular, you're very important when it comes to the semiconductor supply chain. So there's encouraging news about the plants reopening, the workers coming back, getting production up and running. If global trade rebounds next year, which I think it will, more globalized synchronized expansion, China's going to reflate. That's all bullish for ASEAN and your markets in particular. But, you know, Malaysia is very crucial in the global supply chain when it comes to semiconductors. So I hope you don't let us down because we're counting on you.
We certainly will try, Joe. But are there any other ASEAN markets that you're interested in that you think might have earnings growth?
In particular, and I'm sorry, but it's further north. It's going to be like, say, South Korea, Taiwan, Japan, for instance, robotics. But down in general, ASEAN and like Malaysia markets, Singapore, they will get a lift with the global synchronized expansion next year. One market that's done horribly this year, emerging market, is Brazil. They're down, I think, over 10%. So we've got some investors looking there. They're bottom fishing, so to speak. But Brazil's a tough market in terms of, you know, volatility and expected returns.
And we'll jump over to Rome now because it's where the G20 summit is taking place. Now, there was a lot of discussions from a whole range of things, right, to climate to supply side, although there was a lot of criticism that it was really nothing burger. How achievable do you think, though, were the outcomes of the G20 summit in perhaps, you know, helping the U.S. reduce its trade dependence on China?
Well, I mean, I don't think the U.S. should make it a priority to decouple from China and vice versa, because there's so much joined at the hip. So, you know, we saw the United States and Europe roll back the tariffs. Maybe, you know, the U.S. and China can have that same conversation. But, you know, at this juncture, the United States and China still very much, whether it's profits, capital flows, trade, goods, services, very much joined at the hip. And I do think we're at the peak of these global supply chain problems. So the last thing we need is another down leg in U.S.-China trade relations. And we need even just stabilization, status quo would be good heading into next year. So I think that's the market's pricing in. So I'm not a big fan of decoupling, deglobalization. I don't think it's going to happen, but you know, we need to do more dialogue between U.S. and China. That's good for everyone.
And if we just move further north to Glasgow, where the leaders then fly over in their private jets, what do you think they will land and agree on at COP26? And how do you think that will shape markets then moving forward?
I think the markets are just very skeptical of anything concretely coming out of COP26, right or wrong. Doesn't matter, you know, my views or, you know, the global climate change. But I think, you know, renewables have had a good run. They had a phenomenal 2020. They pulled back a little bit here. It's going to be hard, you know, whether it's China, Russia, India. I mean, I saw India, they've got decarbonized by 2070. I mean, you know, come on, that's 50 years now. Who knows what's going to happen between now and then, for God's sake. But nevertheless, renewables continue forward. So I think COP26, hopefully it's not too disappointing with the level set, go back to our corners. But I mean, it's just good to have this conversation. I mean, so COP26 is a success in that sense. Have the conversation, get the world leaders speaking to each other.
And Joe, I'm just curious, in your conversations with clients, perhaps, are they very focused on ESG investing?
Very, very much so, yes. That's top of mind. But there's a lot of confusion around the metrics, who's doing it well, should I get out of fossil fuels, you know, technology uses a lot of energy. So yes, I think maybe too much money has gone into ESG. Everyone wants to do good and well. But maybe that's incompatible in some cases. But ESG is, I think, you know, here to stay. And it's putting a lot of pressure on companies, CEOs, and pension fund managers to speak more about this. And this is a good thing. This is all going to be good long term. But, you know, we're in the first inning or the first baby steps of this process.
All right. Thank you for your time. That was Joe Quinlan, Chief Market Strategist at the U.S. Trust Bank of America Private Wealth Management, giving us his views on global markets and ending the conversation on ESG investing. And yes, a lot of clients want that. There's a lot of hot money flowing into these type of stocks and funds, forcing, I think, companies to change their behavior accordingly. But whether it is greenwashing, I don't know. It's a bit of a question mark I have.
I think it is potentially something worth scrutinizing. But he did also imply they are becoming a bit more expensive as well, because I think it's the trend and fad. But how long will this trend and fad last, essentially, especially when you weed out those that are really genuinely doing it versus those who are greenwashing it?
Yeah, so that's two issues I see, one of which is scarcity value, right? So that's why you see all these prices of these stocks, which are ESG, that meet the ESG criteria, continue to inch up, even in Malaysia, because there's just so much hot money chasing such few ideas. The second thing is that there is no standard criteria as to what is an ESG stock, because I think there's been some reports which show that the top ESG funds in the world had some oil and gas stocks in their portfolio, which, you know, people question. I mean, isn't this the opposite of what it's supposed to achieve? And I don't know, how do you then judge a company, let's say for someone like BP, who is evolving and wants to be, you know, carbon neutral by 2030? Do you put them into the ESG criteria now or later or never?
It's very interesting. It's also like what kind of technologies you take. Like you say, BP, you know, they're investing a lot in algae. But, you know, someone like ExxonMobil, they're working towards carbon storage. So you also have to be clear what is classified, right? And potentially is as a substitution or an adaptation kind of model. It's also the question or whether you classify something under ESG or not.
And speaking of a company that perhaps is not ESG friendly at the moment because it uses fossil fuels, is Avis Budget Group. Now, they reported new record net income and adjusted earnings. And the reason why we want to focus on this stock is because it's a bit of a bellwether, especially in America, in terms of whether travel has resumed and whether this sector has totally recovered from COVID-19. So they ended their third quarter with revenues nearly doubling year on year. But I think this is also because it's just really from a low base effect.
Yeah.
to US $3 billion, 10% higher than analyst expectations. So this is thanks to increased revenue per day and rental days.
I mean, if you look at the stock, 172 up 359%, 359%
low base effect.
Exactly, low base effect, right? Because I think what drove it was the surge in summer travel this period. But Shawnee, you made a very interesting point about that it's not an ESG stock because its competitor Hertz has done an agreement with Tesla to replace its fleet with Tesla cars, right? We haven't seen that yet in Avis, but worth looking out for that.
Yeah, apparently the website for Hertz kind of semi-crashed because there were so many inquiries about the Tesla cars.
Yeah.
People were like eager to book it and try it. But turning our attention to another old economy stock, it's actually Coca-Cola. Now, they bought full control of sports drink maker Body Armor for $5.6 billion, largest acquisition to date after they acquired Costa Coffee for $5.1 billion in 2018. Now, what's so important about Body Armor? They make the, I suppose, sports isotonic drink, second largest in US, and this is because Coca-Cola wants to compete with Pepsi, who is the owner of Gatorade.
Well, I think a small fun factor is that Kobe Bryant, right, that NBA star, is also one of the largest shareholders of Body Armor. It's very interesting, you know, this whole shift. And I mean, these drinks are full of sugar. And if you contrast that to...
They're health drinks, Philip. That's what they sell them as. You exercise and then you drink this sugary drink to
replenish yourself.
Yeah, but to be fair, some of them are sugar-free and maybe they're good salts. But yeah, who knows? Keep it here, BFM 89.9.
Nespresso starts your morning right together with the Morning Run, bringing you the perfect blend of global market insights with expert guests.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.